This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Weathering the shutdown. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As the partial government closure begins a fourth week, small towns with federal workers are feeling the squeeze, like Ogden, Utah.
Ice fishermen are starting to head outdoors, but thanks to high-tech additions, their ice houses have many more comforts of home these days.
New Orleans Saints head coach Sean Payton likes to motivate his players with visuals. Here are the items he had on display at practice this week.
And getting your day off to a much slower start in the morning.
A lot of Americans still view their pre-workday routine as a sprint out the door, and lots of consumer products are still marketed that way. However, there is this growing need or want among consumers to have a moment free of interruption, often free of technology.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron on the counter movement of taking hours to do very little to start the day. That report in about 20 minutes. Far away from the behemoth federal office complexes in Washington, small towns and cities with workforces dependent on government jobs are beginning to feel the pinch of the longest shutdown in history, now more than 3 weeks old. More from Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. Joel, what have you found?
It's a wonderful thing to have a big federal presence, typically, if you're a small town, because what you have is the stability of the federal government. It gives you a buffer against economic downturns. We see that here in D.C., but that stability suddenly goes out the window during a shutdown, and people are worried in some of these places that have a big federal presence. They're worried about, well, how long is this thing going to last, you know, and how is this going to affect my budget and my ability to, you know, buy a new car, that kind of thing.
All right, so just north of Salt Lake City is Ogden, Utah. Explain what's happening there.
Well, Ogden is a place that has a big IRS presence, and it has a U.S. Forest Service presence, and they're both shut down. You understand that some of the government is funded and some isn't. And if you're unlucky enough to have a big presence of federal office workers, you know, federal workers, federal agencies, from these shutdown agencies, like the Commerce is shut down, the EPA is shut down, Homeland Security is shut down. Now, what they do, and the Justice Department is shut down. If one place that I looked into was West Virginia. You may remember, Gordon, when Senator Robert Byrd was in the Senate for 51 years, he brought in a lot of money to West Virginia. So there are places where you have big federal office complexes off of I-79 between Morgantown and Clarksburg. This is a part of the country that's, you know, economically depressed. You know, the coal industry is in decline. Some of the old glass factories from way back in the day, or shoe factories, those things have closed decades ago. So what do? You bring in the federal government, and you have NASA, and you have the FBI has a huge fingerprint lab near Clarksburg, West Virginia. Well, that's closed. Actually, it's not closed. It's affected by the furlough because it doesn't have any funding. So the people who are working without pay, and a lot of people are not working at all. No one's getting paid. So that has an impact on these relatively small communities.
Wow. We're speaking with Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. He's written a piece about U.S. towns with federal workers kind of bracing for this kind of extended shutdown period. How about just something simple like the impact on restaurants?
Well, sure. And keep one thing in mind, that when we talk about the federal government, and we don't do a great job sometimes in the news media of explaining this, a lot of people are not federal employees. They're contractors. In fact, there's been an effort over the last couple of decades to shift a lot of the government functions, such as sort of back office functions, IT and technical support, and to shift a lot of that stuff away from the federal government in terms of, you know, a full-time civil servant who works for the government, shift that to private contractors. Well, what happens when a shutdown is hundreds of thousands of those private contractors get stop work orders. They're never going to get that money back. So this is actually going to hurt them, you know, right now, even if Congress restores the pay of the federal workers who are full-time. The private contractors are already facing a situation where they're going to have less money coming in, and that affects, you know, you mentioned restaurants. I talked to someone in Fairmont, West Virginia. They've had a restaurant there for 50 years. You know, so far they haven't seen a lot of impact, but they're bracing for it because people, you know, want to know that this is going to end soon. And right now there's no end in sight because of the political dynamics of it, in which this whole issue has become so totally polarized along the lines of whether or not to build the wall. You know, the president made his promise. The Democrats say no way, and you know, it's hard to see what the script is for resolving it. So, yeah, if you have an auto dealership or a restaurant or any kind of retail operation, it's concerning. And there are some places, like our reporter in Ogden, Utah, saw that the business was way down in that area around where all the government offices are. So the people who normally serve lunch to lots and lots of federal office workers, but those buildings are dark. So, you know, it's a hardship for those folks.
Thanks, Joel. Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Boy Scouts projects to earn the coveted Eagle Scout rank have long been wholesome efforts, right? To build bridges over creeks and parks, installing handrails, or assembling meal kits for needy children. But in an age of fear of school shootings, some have a new focus: preparing for armed killers. It's a story by Wall Street Journal education reporter Leslie Brody. Leslie, what's going on here?
I was just surprised to hear that students in the Boy Scouts, who have often done things like clean up parks or build bike racks or give blankets to homeless people, are now tackling sort of a darker themed project in terms of trying to help their schools be ready in the off chance there's a mass shooting. One young man named Andrew Lachese, he's 17 and he's a senior, he is spent this past weekend putting together medical kits that are anti-bleeding kits that have gauze and trauma shears and special bandages that are very absorbent in case teachers have to help stanch blood loss if there's a shooting or other kind of emergency in the schools, which is such a grim thought. I mean, it may be a good idea, but it's I think some parents think it's sad that we've come to a place where this is what's on teenagers' minds.
Yeah. Did you say, too, that he initially proposed this like a day before the Parkland school shooting?
Yes, isn't that ironic?
Wow.
So the Boy Scout officials approved it right away. It's a project, you have to do a service project to get the coveted Eagle Scout rank. So Boy Scouts have to come up with ideas, and this was on his mind, and he proposed it right before the Parkland shooting.
It's incredible. So how many of these kits are there, I guess? Are they just for his high school, that Glen Ridge High School?
Well, he's doing it for his whole district, which is a small suburban district right outside New York City, and there are four schools. So he's doing it for his district with some of his Boy Scout buddies. But he's not the only one. I mean, there's a young man in Aiken, South Carolina, who did similar kits. He called them lockdown kits. And another young man in outside of Sacramento, California, made these curtains with magnets that could quickly cover up the windows of classroom doors in case students had to sort of hide inside the classrooms if there was an active shooter roaming in the hallways. And then, of course, very sadly, back when the Sandy Hook Elementary School had that awful shooting in 2012, 8 of the child victims were Girl Scouts who were DAISYs, which is the youngest division, which is, you know, kindergarten and first graders. So at that point, there were a lot of Girl Scout projects tied to memorials for the children who were killed. One is still in a park in Middletown, Connecticut. It's like this big metal DAISY sculpture. So this is where our kids are today.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal education reporter Leslie Brody. She's written an interesting piece entitled, In Age of Mass Shootings, Boy Scout Projects Hope to Keep Schools Safe. Going back to Mr. Lachese there in New Jersey, how did he raise his money to put these kits together?
Oh, he was resourceful. He had a GoFundMe page. He got other donations. He also sold coffee to commuters at the train station. So he raised $4,500. It didn't take him that long. You know, he's very enterprising. He happens to be a volunteer for the local ambulance squad. He is trained as an emergency medical technician, and he spends about 18 hours a week on call for that. So I think the idea of, you know, the fact that you can bleed out so quickly was on his mind. I mean, apparently there's often a lag time before the emergency medical teams can, the professionals can get to a school or other site of a mass shooting. And during that time, you know, you could bleed to death. Apparently it only takes 5 minutes in certain circumstances to bleed to death. And sometimes when the police are clearing an area, they don't let the medical professionals in right away. So I think his view was to help, you know, teachers or other staff members who would be on site already know what to do.
Thanks, Leslie. Wall Street Journal education reporter Leslie Brody. 21 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for joining us. How fast can you get out the door in the morning? Did you know that a race against the clock may be working against you? This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka says there may be a better way.
If you wake up early so you can do nothing, you may be on to something. As Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal tells us, a slow morning may be the perfect antidote to our hectic lives. Ellen, what are the slow morning enthusiasts doing or not doing?
Well, they are waking up hours before they necessarily need to in order to have a very calm, unrushed start to their day.
Are they just sitting around? Are they reading? What kinds of things are they doing?
A little bit of everything. Some people genuinely do just sit around and make sure that the beginning of their day starts on their own terms without interruption and without any rushing. Others do various movement or I found one man who really enjoys slowly bouncing on a trampoline to get started. Others like cold therapy, jumping in a lake or in a cold shower to really get their breathing and mind all in sync. There's meditation, certainly. Others pursue hobbies in the morning, but they all share this similar goal of waking up and doing what they choose to do without interruption before preparing to leave for their day jobs.
Ellen, doesn't this run counter to our society of kind of grabbing and going and just running to work?
It does. And of course, a lot of Americans still view their pre-workday routine as a sprint out the door, and lots of consumer products are still marketed that way. However, there is this growing need or want among consumers to have a moment free of interruption, often free of technology, and even some solitude to really start their day in a slow fashion. And then that in turn energizes and really fuels the rest of their day. Some business executives told me about how this helps with their creative thinking, for example. Others just feel like not having a rush at the beginning of their day helps them rush through the rest of their day.
You mentioned earlier, Ellen, meditation. Does that go along with the general focus on yoga and that kind of stuff these days?
There is this focus among a lot of mainstream consumers to have some sort of self-care woven into their day. And certainly meditation has become a more popular form of doing that. I did speak with Calm, which is a meditation app, and their peak hour for meditation practice is between 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. And what that tells executives there is that many people like to wake up and do this first before starting their regularly scheduled day.
We're speaking with Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal. Just in very general terms, Ellen, how long are people doing nothing or meditating or being calm?
For some, it's an hour. For others, it's many hours. And they love having this time of, some describe it as liberation, where they can really just go from task to task or do no tasks for a long period at the beginning of their day.
Ellen, your story quoted the founder of the World Institute of Slowness. What is that?
It's a think tank, and they also consult with companies. It's based in Norway, but their clients are certainly global. And they, the founder, really promotes this idea of business leaders needing to take time to forget about time, and that in turn will help them be creative when they arrive at work. And so business leaders should be thoughtful about the first things they do before they start their work day in order to really energize their creative juices.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. By the way, on the World Institute of Slowness website, the founder says, don't live life as if you're afraid of being late to your own funeral. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on this weekend.
Grainger stands for safety, and they know what safety stands for. S, safety. A, all about safety. F, feeling good about safety. E, extreme safety. T, talking about safety. Y, you guessed it, safety. First aid kits, eyewash stations, fire protection, you name it. For over 90 years, they've been helping to keep facilities safe and people safer. When it comes to safety, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the tech question that everyone asks but no one understands. Also, party on ice, fishing houses, go high tech. And what Saints coach Sean Payton uses to motivate players. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Clemson in recent years has climbed into rare air with Alabama and stayed there, as evidenced by last week's dominating 44-16 win over the Crimson Tide in the college football national championship game. The formulas for the two teams are quite different. Alabama creates and then exploits its advantages, and Clemson figures out a cheaper and curvier way to get to the same place. It's a story by Wall Street Journal sports writer Rachel Bachman. Rachel, how has Clemson done it?
One of the things Clemson did about 5 years ago was to hire a small social media team to really try to punch above their weight in terms of spreading their brand and also create content that would show recruits that this is a fun place to be. And that really has yielded some great results. The kind of the image of their brand has really risen among recruits. They actually stole an offensive lineman away from the state of Ohio, from Ohio State, a guy I talked to a few days ago. And so they've really had some great successes with creating original videos and kind of fun things that recruits have been connecting with.
All right. So Alabama, I would presume, has the resources to do that. They just don't do that, or Clemson does it better in this case?
Yeah, well, Alabama definitely has, you know, of course it has its own social media presence and so on. What Clemson did was they said, we have to be different. We have to stand out. So while what comes out of other schools, and I would say Alabama included, tends to be, if they have a video presence at all, it tends to be sort of like a Hard Knocks kind of documentary style clips where it's just sort of a fly on the wall, you know, camera in the room, and they show things that are happening around the program. At Clemson, you know, they create original content. They had something that came out in December called How the Grinch Almost Stole Clemson Signing Day. And it's this whole, you know, sort of sketch with the Grinch going to the football facility and talking about how he wished he'd been recruited and so on. And so it's, you know, it's very creative. Other videos include, you know, head coach Dabo Swinney talking to the camera about, you know, how great this is or that is, and, you know, introducing people to, you know, viewers to people in the program. So it's a much more camera-facing, friendly, fun, kind of upbeat vibe that Clemson modeled after the YouTube celebrity Casey Neistat, who's this very self-made guy. He's very kind of informal, but hugely popular, and he has that same camera-facing sort of I'm just a regular guy kind of approach.
Yet, as you point out in the story, Alabama for I don't know how many years in a row has landed the number one recruiting class. How do those things square?
Yes. Well, you know, Clemson is really catching up. I mean, it doesn't have one of the, you know, top one or two classes, but you know, they've been in the top 10 or 15 consistently in recent years. And you know, that's quite impressive for a school that is, you know, 2.5 hours from the nearest major airport. I talked to the social media guy at Clemson. He said, you know, our goal is really to get recruits to visit because nobody drops by Clemson, South Carolina. Really have to make a point to get there. And so they really have made some headway in especially getting out-of-state recruits to come in. You know, their freshman quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, is from Georgia. So, they've convinced him to go out-of-state to play in South Carolina. So they've had some very big wins in recruiting at key areas.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Rachel Bachman. She's got an interesting piece entitled The Rivalry That Shouldn't Be, How Clemson Competes with Alabama. There was an interesting survey that you pointed out in this story, too, where like far more kids like chose Clemson as what, more interesting or something than Alabama?
Yeah, basically, an online firm polled 224 high school football recruits, and they purposely chose recruits who were not, you know, like A-level type recruits. They're just high school football players, so they wouldn't be influenced by their interactions with coaching staff. So they're forming their impressions based on what they see, you know, social media, online, on TV, and these 224 high school football players ranked Clemson number one in terms of, you know, a place where if they had the chance, they would want to be. I think Alabama was 19th. So, you know, that certainly speaks to Clemson's efforts to sort of get the word out about how much fun it is to be there succeeding.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal sports writer Rachel Bachman. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. One of the most common questions an analyst is asked is which product is better? We could be talking PCs, laptops, tablets, smartphones, maybe servers, storage, networking, or even cars. Analysts always have the answer, but Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group, argues that the answer is generally the wrong one. The reason is, he says, there are always foundational elements that those who are asked the question don't know. Rob, what are you looking at?
Well, so what I'm talking about here is the fact that we don't ask what it is you really want to do with the thing. Everybody's a little bit different. And so what I did is I broke down the set of laptops that I had and talked a bit about what each one of them was best for. So, for instance, the HP Folio is best when, Spectre Folio is best when you're, you know, want to hold the laptop, probably ideal for attorneys. It's a better tablet experience than any of the others, while if you're really working in a more traditional laptop fashion, it's hard to beat a Lenovo ThinkPad. If you're just going to work it out with a PC, then that's a very different product. And here's the screwy thing, is we all have different parts of our job, often whether we're working at the desk or whether we're working standing up or doing something else. And sometimes that may mean we need several types of notebook computers to do what we want to do best.
Do analysts not communicate this well?
Well, the problem is often when people are asking the question, they don't really define what it is that they like to do, and so it becomes very difficult to respond and say, hey, this would be the best one for you. It'd be very much like you're trying to pick an automobile for somebody, but you don't know whether they really like driving fast with a top down or hauling a whole bunch of folks around to soccer matches or whatever. Your choices range from a convertible Miata to a full-sized SUV and everything in between. So without knowing how the thing is going to be used or how you prefer to work, it becomes almost impossible to identify a particular product that would be best for you. And as I say, it's a choice. It's very different for every single person, and might actually be different for you during a given week or a given month. Yeah. The product you might like on one day might be completely different than the product you might like on something else some other day.
You need a spreadsheet, I guess, of needs and wants and what you can pass on, I guess, in an emergency.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you really just need to sit down and think a bit about how you work and how you'd like to work, because a lot of times the way you work is limited by the product that you have. So if you've got a really big laptop computer, you're not going to use it as a tablet. It's simply going to be too heavy, but maybe that's the way you would like to work, which means probably you should have something else, something that you can hold and carry. And, of course, increasingly, because we're connected to the web and to what we call the cloud for most of our productivity stuff, battery life now and connectivity becomes the overarching requirement, stepping away from processing power, which is really what drove the laptops in the last couple decades.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm known as the Enderle Group. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, the onset of ice fishing season should be just weeks away in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, and with it comes the renewal of a pastime that is much about camaraderie as it is about catching fish. For many, time spent in ice fishing houses is to be cherished, and the houses themselves are as individual as the people who take refuge in them. Luxurious ice fishing houses have become more popular in the upper Midwest the last couple of years. Rick Barrett at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has been exploring them. Rick, what'd you see?
It's a lot of fun out there. I mean, traditionally, ice fishing shanties have been pretty modest. I mean, you know, some guys will take their hunting shack or something like that, stitch it together, put it on a sled, haul it out on the ice. It's a good thing. But these latest ice fishing shanties, if you want to call them that, are really more like a deluxe RV. I mean, they're just amazing. These have everything in it that you can think of, and, you know, forced air furnaces. They have, you know, electric bunk beds that you push a button and they slide down. They have ceiling fans. What else do they have in these things? They have, you know, everything you would find in a luxury camper or a travel trailer.
Wow. So this forced air furnace that might be inside a fishing house on a lake, you're not melting the ground beneath you and leading to your own demise, are you?
No, you're not doing that, fortunately. You know, inside some of these shanties, it gets really warm. I mean, they crank up the heat to 70-some degrees. And, you know, you take your jacket off and be in your shirt sleeves. It's wow. It's very comfortable. But, you know, heat rises. And so, and the ice is still thick enough underneath the shanty that it might make it a little bit soft on the top, but it's not going to do anything to, you know, threaten the integrity of the ice.
Wow. How about the purists who go back a couple of decades? Are they in favor of this?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of them just prefer to take the old shanty out on the ice, just the wooden shack with a wood-burning stove and, you know, the way they've always done it for generations. There's so many good memories with these little shanties out there that folks get very attached to them.
Sure. It looks like a ton of fun, I must say. We're speaking with Rick Barrett, business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, part of the USA Today Network. He's got a fascinating piece entitled Party on Ice, Fishing Houses Go High Tech to Bring All Comforts to the Lake in Winter. You mentioned one guy, he's got he cut a hole in the ice and then dropped a camera down. He's able to watch things underwater, right, on a screen inside his shack?
Yeah, a lot of the guys do that now, Gordon. They have the underwater cameras now. where they can pretty much see everything underneath there for the schools of fish, and they'll monitor that on a big flat screen TV set inside the shanty.
Boy, powered by a generator, I presume?
Yeah, it'd be powered by a generator in that case. Or a good battery setup too.
Yeah.
You know, they can use like marine type batteries and get a lot of use out of those without a generator running.
How about the electric beds though? Right, coming down out of a wall or something, maximizing space. That'd be a ton of fun. I've never done that, but that is probably on my longer bucket list of things to do. Ice fishing in luxury. Rick Barrett at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Hardware, cash, and jewelry. New Orleans Saints football coach Sean Payton is using some serious visuals to motivate his players this playoff weekend. The Lombardi Trophy, stacks of cash totaling more than $200,000, and a Super Bowl ring were among the sights that Saints players saw at team headquarters this week. Saints play the later game Sunday against the Eagles. Why the $200,000 in cash? It represents the bonuses players are entitled to through each stage of the playoffs. Division round victory gets you $29,000, conference championship $54,000, and the Super Bowl win means $118,000. That's $201,000 for each player. Payton has used visual props to get messages through before. After the team started 0-4 back in 2007, Coach Payton parked a wagon full of instruments meant to resemble an empty bandwagon alongside the practice field. Rat traps around team headquarters occasionally signify trap games against heavy underdogs, or gas cans in the lockers of veterans as a way of challenging them, metaphorically, to show that they still have gas in their tanks. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.